Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Side Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and I'm with co-host Russ Chianelli. And today we're going to be talking about a phenomenon that you probably have heard of, superconductivity. What is it? What's its utility? And so, Russ, as usual, we know very little. Who's our guest?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio a longtime friend and colleague, Dr. Alan Jacobson, who is a Welsh professor of chemistry and chemical engineering at the University of Houston. But in addition to that, he is the director of the Texas Center for Superconductivity.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Alan, before we get cracking on the concepts of superconductivity and your contributions to it, and what on earth is a Texas Center of Superconductivity, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where you grew up, what were the features that sort of pushed you into a scientific career?
Well, I grew up in Newcastle-on-Tyne in England, and I can always remember as a boy being interested in chemistry, even before I went to grammar school, to high school, as it were. And my interest in it continued through grammar school on to university, and I have made a career out of it ever since.
And what were you doing in grammar school with chemistry?
Well, the usual things, you know. We did. There was a lot of lab work back in those days, which you don't see now in high school chemistry departments, but we made things. We made organic compounds, we did distillations, and we did other kinds of experiments that were sort of less orthodox, perhaps more fun. You know, stinks and bangs. We made minor explosions to entertain the chemistry teacher and things like that.
We're not allowed to do that anymore, almost. It's interesting. I'm going to be teaching a sophomore class in 2 weeks, and I requested a certain room so I could do demonstrations. And this has caused all sorts of ructions. Demonstrations? Well, is there a fume hood in there? I said, no. Well, they said, well, how are you going to do the demonstration? Etc. So you're so perceptive, and we all know this, that the experimental part of chemistry and a lot of sciences is sort of being given short shrift. And I'm not quite sure what the next generation of chemists are going to be thinking.
Alan and I had similar backgrounds as kids. You make a volcano or something like that. That's right. The kind of stuff that gets people turned on.
It turns people on, and there's a lot of concern about getting students involved in STEM subjects. You know, and the more they see of those kinds of things, the more engaged I think they get.
Right.
We run an outreach program through the Texas Center for Superconductivity to local area schools, and we try very hard to build in a lot of demonstrations because it really captures their imagination.
Volcanoes?
No, afraid not. We have to do other things. We did have an ACS local chapter here at the university who did do some things like that, and unfortunately they set all the fire alarms off in the building. So that finished that for a while.
Yeah, and in fact, for our point of view, we share a new big $90 million building with the computer scientists, and they have this white coat syndrome like you wouldn't believe.
Right.
But anyway, so then you went to university and studied chemistry. Where did you go? What did you sort of specialize in as an undergraduate or a graduate student?
I went to St. Catherine's College, Oxford, which actually has just celebrated its 50th anniversary. I was in the first group of students who actually went there in 1962. And I studied chemistry. And in the Oxford system, you don't do much else. Right. You major in something, and basically that's all you do, except a bit of languages. But so I did chemistry for 3 years. And then in the Oxford system, they have a 1 year of research requirement to complete your bachelor's degree. And that was when I became interested in solid-state chemistry, and that's where I have been ever since.
Well, I mean, it's actually, I think our listeners would be quite interested to know that there is a college at Oxford that's only 50 years old.
Yeah.
One tends to think of 300, 200.
So when did you get your PhD? What year was that?
I got my PhD in 1968.
I know you from Exxon Research and Engineering in New Jersey, but what did you do before then?
Oh, after I got my PhD, I was a postdoc in Oxford for a year, and then I joined the faculty.
This is a typical Oxford story.
I had a classic Oxford career.
Right, absolutely. Well done. But you were finally prized away.
Well, I looked at myself after I'd been there for 13 or 14 years, and I thought, you know, if I don't do something, I'm going to be here the rest of my life.
All right. Well, you certainly came somewhere very different in the end. Let's talk about two things. First of all, we'll start with solid-state chemistry. That's what you said that you know you first got into.
Right.
So why don't you tell the audience, you know, what distinguishes solid-state chemistry from chemistry, or what branch it is, and then how did that move you into now being the in charge of this Texas superconductivity program?
Well, solid-state chemistry is about chemistry of solids, as you can imagine. And it's about, I have worked mostly on oxide materials, ceramic materials, that have various kinds of applications in energy-producing devices. I've worked on various kinds of solid oxide materials that have useful and interesting properties in often in energy-related materials, in energy-related applications, but also in electronics and in magnetism and all sorts of other things.
Well, let's just sort of hone in on what you would call an energy-related property.
I know that you worked on fuel cells, for example. Might you tell us a little bit about fuel cells?
When I first went to Exxon, I worked on lithium-ion batteries. So I've worked on batteries. I've worked on zeolites for catalysis and for separations of molecules. I work on fuel cells. That's my own area of research for energy production.
Well, talk a little bit about the fuel cell and how a solid oxide is involved for our audience in a fuel cell.
Okay. Well, a fuel cell is like it's like any kind of electrochemical device. It has three main components. It has an electrolyte, which transports ions from one side of the cell to the other. And then it has electrodes. It has a positive electrode and a negative electrode. And in a high-temperature solid oxide fuel cell, the fuel cell takes oxygen from air, and it dissociates it and transports it across the electrolyte. And then when it emerges on the other side, it reacts with whatever fuel is being used, let us say hydrogen, or it could be a hydrocarbon, or it could be something else, and it converts it to CO2 and water. And the overall electrochemical process generates energy in a very efficient way.
All right. So give us an example of where a fuel cell might be seen in the future or even now.
There are fuel cells that are commercially available. I mean, they're used for power generation. There's one here. There's a Toshiba plant outside of Houston that has a 100-kilowatt fuel cell that's used for refrigeration of the plant.
And so tell us how that works. What's the fuel that it uses?
Well, in that case, it uses hydrogen.
And where does the hydrogen come from?
Well, the hydrogen comes from hydrocarbons. All hydrogen comes from hydrocarbons, whatever people tell you.
What about water?
Well, there is no economically way of making hydrogen from water.
That surely should be still one of our major research goals.
Absolutely.
I mean, the number of papers that have been published over the last 20 years on ruthenium catalysts that take...
That's a major challenge, to find efficient ways of converting, extracting hydrogen from water, preferably using solar energy. But that's really a really important research topic.
Well, what's the big hang-up there? I mean, given I'm not in the field, but I've read so many, because a lot of these catalysts are metal catalysts, metal complexes. What's the big hang-up? Where's the big bottleneck, if you like, in making progress?
You need a fair amount of energy to do it. You have to dissociate a water molecule. And so you have to find a way of getting the energy into the system effectively. So you need a very efficient catalyst, and it just isn't...
Let's talk a little bit about the batteries, too, because... back in those days, we had batteries that were much more volumetrically efficient than lead-acid batteries. But the problem with the batteries always was finding an electrolyte that would make a lithium battery work safely.
Well, I mean, lithium batteries have evolved over many years to the point where they're actually pretty good right now. I mean, they're getting to the point where, you know, that they will go into vehicles, I think, lithium-ion batteries, which are not the same as the original ones that were developed back in the 70s. But there are still issues with them, and one of the main issues with them is safety, and it always has been.
And that's because of the electrolyte or because of metallic lithium or both?
Well, it's not metallic lithium anymore. There's no metallic lithium in the current lithium-ion battery.
Okay.
It's all lithium and graphite or whatever the anode material is. But it's partly the electrolyte, it's partly that you're dealing with a system that is inherently contains a large amount of energy, and so things can go wrong.
It seems to me I remember that the Japanese were making electric vehicles which would catch on fire in the parking lots.
Yeah, I mean, there have been some. I have some pictures of cars that have caught fire because of lithium batteries. Yeah.
Well, I mean, just recently, this Dreamliner, the 787, they've been having power plants within them, not where they're flying, luckily, which have suddenly spontaneously caught fire. And as you point out, that any time you've got a battery system with storing energy, you know, things can go wrong.
Right.
And there we are.
There's a lot of history. You know, there were high-temperature batteries that were developed in the U.S. by Ford Motor Company and by Argon back in the 70s, and they use molten sodium and molten lithium. And,
that's right.
You know, to be fair now, NJK in Japan actually commercialized a sodium sulfur battery, and they are available. You can buy them, and there are actually two in Texas, quite large ones, used for load leveling in utilities. So,
and they contain liquid sodium.
Yes.
Well, in fact, liquid sodium in other guises is used as a coolant also.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's not quite as dramatic. And we have
NGK went through a lot of safety testing. I mean, they dropped one off a building, I remember, in order to see what would happen to it. And it survived.
Well, that reminds me of a story once in the laboratory of mine here. A student who hadn't read properly how to dry a particular solvent, it was a chlorocarbon, lots of chlorine in the solvent, started squeezing in sodium. And, you know, I didn't find out about it until I came in the lab and saw this still, and it was just refluxing away. And I said, hey, what is this? And they said, well, it was methylene chloride, dichloromethane, with sodium ribbon. And I sort of froze in my tracks. I thought it should have exploded. And so I said, look, just get out of the laboratory, turn it off, and nothing happened. And then I had a postdoc, a German postdoc, who was very tall, who picked the flask up and gingerly went, we were on the fourth floor, went to a window and dropped it out of the window down to about two floors underneath the basement, because there's a valley there or an arroyo. But it didn't explode. Nothing happened to it. It didn't even break. It landed in our West Texas sand. Anyway, enough of those silly reminiscences. You're listening to Science Studio. My name's Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli and in Houston, Alan Jacobson of the University of Houston, who is the Welsh Professor of Chemistry and Chemical Engineering. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neisel. Tuberculosis, or TB, used to be a death sentence. In the 20th century, TB was called consumption and killed over 100 million people.
When effective antibiotics came on the scene, the death rate plummeted and people thought TB could be eliminated. Then the bacterium Mycobacterium tuberculosis made a comeback. In the 1980s, effective antibiotics against TB stopped working until scientists discovered they could combine them.
But that also didn't last. In recent years, TB again evolved, with some strains resistant against even the antibiotic cocktails. TB's reemergence this time is largely due to the global HIV epidemic and the virus's suppression of the immune system.
14 million people worldwide are co-infected with HIV and TB, and without treatment, most will die. Fortunately, researchers recently identified several new combinations of antibiotics that seem to work.
One new cocktail is called PA-824, consists of moxifloxacin, a relatively new antibiotic, and pyrazinamide, an older TB antibiotic. This combination works faster than current therapies and doesn't seem to interact with HIV drugs.
At least three other drugs or combinations are in the testing pipeline, just in time to treat multiply drug-resistant forms of TB. TB is highly contagious and is spread by droplets in the air from an infected person's sneeze or cough.
A person with active TB typically has a long-lasting cough, weight loss, fever, and night sweats. Left uncontrolled, TB becomes miliary TB, which causes extensive lung damage and death.
There's now a global initiative to control the spread of TB, so these new drug treatments are timely and urgently needed.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Professor Alan Jacobson, Welsh Professor of Chemistry and Chemical Engineering at the University of Houston. And we've been talking about solar cells. We've been talking about many things, as a matter of fact, to do with ceramics and solid-state chemistry. But I think it's time to move on to the whole concept of this superconductivity, because you are indeed the head of the Texas Institute of Superconductivity. So, Alan, Tell us, what is superconductivity? Why should we be excited about it? And what is Texas doing having a center specifically to study it?
Well, superconductivity is a really unusual property that certain materials possess, which is that when they're cooled below a certain temperature, they lose all resistance to electricity. And so they become perfect conductors of electricity. And they also have another property, which is an important property, is that in the superconducting state, below the transition temperature, in the superconducting state, they repel magnetic fields. Both of those properties are the basis of applications. As far as the Texas Center for Superconductivity is concerned, the Texas Center for Superconductivity was established in 1987, I guess. It was set up by the state of Texas, and it was set up after Paul Chu, who is a professor of physics here at the University of Houston, discovered superconductivity in a material called yttrium barium copper oxide, or IBCO as we call it. And what was unusual about that was that it went superconducting above the boiling point of liquid nitrogen.
And what temperature is that, just for our audience?
77 Kelvin. And just to say a little bit about the history, I mean, superconductivity has been around for a long time. It's actually, last year was the 100th anniversary of the discovery of superconductivity by Kamerlingh Onnes, a Dutch physicist. And so it evolved over many years, but it was all what is known as low-temperature superconductivity, in that the transition temperatures were all less than 25 degrees Kelvin. And so what was the breakthrough came, not here, it came actually from Bednors and Müller in Zurich, who discovered in 1986 a material, a ceramic material, that went superconducting at 35 Kelvin. And that's produced an enormous outburst of research, and it led, among other things, to the discovery by Paul of YBCO, which goes superconducting at 91 Kelvin.
I mean, it's interesting that you point out, and I think most people, if you took them off the street and asked them, would say, well, you know, the superconducting materials would have been metals, because I think mercury was one of the first ones at these low temperatures. And then you said that that big discovery, I think that was IBM, right?
Yes.
And that was a ceramic. Mm-hmm. And ceramics are sort of typically, in most people's eyes, piece of china, you know, a cup is a ceramic, and you don't
solid state material,
and you don't think of them as being conducting. So that was two breakthroughs, as it were, it not?
Right. Although there had been some earlier examples of ceramic superconductors, but they were actually pretty low temperature before Bednors and Müller discovered the cuprates, the copper oxide based system.
And one other question: we used to call this 1-2-3.
Yeah,
but you call it YPCO.
Well, it was called 1-2-3 because it's one yttrium, two bariums, and three coppers in the chemical formula.
So that was about 25 years ago or something like that,
25
right?
25 years ago.
Right. So now tell me that temperature that you mentioned, 77, because 77 is nice from a scientific point of view, but socially it's just not going to work. We're not going to have liquid nitrogen cooled transmission lines. So where are we nowadays, and what progress have we made?
Let me say two things about that. First, it's not clear that we won't have nitrogen-cooled transmission lines.
Oh.
And I'll say a little bit more about that in a second. But to answer the other question about the highest temperature that's been achieved is 164 degrees Kelvin. And there's not been anything higher. That was done back in 1990. Or something like that, but there has been no higher temperature material.
And exactly what material is that?
That was a mercury barium calcium copper oxide. It's another one of the copper oxide family.
Now, one of the things, I was fortunate to be invited to the 25th anniversary and listening to all this, but one of the things that's always intrigued me about this, watching it over the years, is that from what I see, we really do not understand how these materials work. Is that correct?
Yes. Unlike low-temperature superconductors, i.e. the materials that have enormous commercial applications, like niobium titanium and niobium 3-tin, where there is a very comprehensive theory and understanding of those materials called BCS theory that was developed by Bardeen Cooper and Schrieffer, who got the Nobel Prize for that, But there is no comparable theory that explains the behavior of any of the high-temperature superconductors.
So, I mean, is it clear then that the current research is really, if I can go back to that old adage of bake and shake, you're just making various combinations of the metals and the metal oxides and just studying. So, I mean, there's an awful lot of poking around in the dark and doing experiments to see, hey, is this a good conductor?
Well, there are two things that are going on right now in the field. One is that people are searching for new materials. Because there is no, as far as my physics colleagues tell me, there is no fundamental reason why you can't get superconductivity at still higher temperatures. And so there are a lot of people who are doing what they would call materials discovery, which, as you described it, bake and
shake. Shake and bake.
I would call it experience guided by intuition.
Yes.
Wonderful. I'll agree to that.
But the other thing that's going on, which is very important, is this, that there are commercial applications now that are being developed of high-temperature superconductors. And so there's a tremendous amount of work that is focused on that. And it's nearly all on yttrium-barium copper oxide. Not quite all, but almost all of it is on yttrium-barium copper oxide.
I remember these stories about chains of copper oxygen in the structure and so on. What does your intuition tell you about why these things superconduct? Forget about the theorists for a moment.
Well, I mean, the problem is that in order to understand why they superconduct, you have to understand what the pairing mechanism is. There has to be some way of coupling the electrons together to form Cooper pairs. And in BCS theory, in low-temperature superconductor theory, what couples them together are interactions with phonons or with lattice vibrations. Now, the problem with high-temperature superconductors is there's no consensus on what the pairing mechanism is. And so there are various possibilities. It's almost certainly not phonons, but it could be magnetic in origin. It could be ferroelectric-related, some kind of ferroelectric distortion-related phenomenon. There are a number of possibilities, but there is no consensus.
Let me, if I may, we've got 5 minutes to go, and I'd like to sort of get back to this intriguing, you know, statement that you made that was sort of debunking my thought that you'd never have liquid nitrogen cooled transmission lines. You sort of said, yes, indeed, that there's a possibility. Tell us what the people in this business then are thinking. That's quite a dramatic thought process for me to get through.
There's a 600-kilometer long superconducting transmission line demonstration project in Long Island that is cooled by liquid nitrogen.
I didn't know that.
And there's another one in New York State that connects two substations in Albany. So the technology has developed to the point where, I'm not saying it's there yet, because it isn't, because there are a lot of issues that have to do with cost and that they have to do with acceptability. But in the last 25 years, it's made a tremendous amount of progress towards large-scale commercialization in electric power.
Well, I think for one thing to point out that our copper transmission lines lose about 16% or something like that energy for each, certain distance, so that if you're going from a power station to your home, it's very inefficient. And with a superconductor, that power loss through conductivity doesn't occur.
Well,
so that's why we want to do it.
Yeah, that's right. Let's be clear about that, though. It depends. If it's AC transmission, then there are still some power losses, but they're much reduced with superconductors. If it's DC transmission, then they're none at all.
So I remember people in New York City were putting lines, copper lines, under the roads, and they were filling these tubes with liquid nitrogen so that they could stretch them, push them through. So if we're talking about superconducting liquid nitrogen cooled, we're talking about a tube with the conductor in it?
Yeah, I mean, they come in various designs, but essentially that captures it. I mean, they have a central tube that carries the nitrogen, and then the superconductors are wound around. It's a bit more complicated than that because you have, if it's AC, you have to have three phases, and so you have to figure out how to put all that in a cryostat. To be honest with you, you know, this is developing, but it's not where the first applications of high-temperature superconductors are going to come. And part of it is because it has to do with acceptability to the electric utilities. It's going to take a long time before they're convinced that they can use it. But it will occur sooner in things like transformers, wind generator systems, in electric motors. And there's a tremendous number of applications in those areas.
Do you think we're at the technology already, the TC is high enough that those applications could basically come online tomorrow, maybe yesterday, for all we know?
Well, they're at the development stage. I mean, they're not. I don't mean small-scale development. I mean large-scale development.
And that's part of what the Texas Institute's all about?
Yeah, we have some work going on in the applications areas. A lot of what we do is on wire development, in trying to improve the performance and the properties of superconducting wire, and also reduce the cost. Cost is a limiting factor.
What's your prediction here? Do you think we're going to all of a sudden see something at room temperature in the near future?
I can't predict that. I mean, all I can say is that people are trying. And I say one other thing about it, and that is that if you look in the literature, you will find, and I think I'm pretty sure this is true, that you will find that every year somebody discovers a new superconductor.
As a matter of fact, there wasn't there some...
hang on a minute, but that's a new superconductor that hasn't really changed the TC at all.
No, I mean, they come in, yes. In different TCs. There was one class of compounds that was recently discovered in Japan, quite different from anything else that goes superconducting at around 50 Kelvin.
I see. So your point is that all sorts of combinations of elements, oxides, metals, nonmetals,
yeah,
that are out there to be discovered, and
right,
one of them may suddenly turn up trumps.
Absolutely. And in fact, one of the most remarkable examples recently in the 90s was the discovery that magnesium diboride, a very simple compound, magnesium diboride actually went superconducting. And that compound's been known for I don't know how long.
Wasn't there a report recently about something about graphite and liquid ammonia or something? I remember people talking about that.
Yeah, there's a lot of controversy about that.
But they were claiming room temperature.
Yeah, there's a lot of controversy about that. We have a saying. It's called USOs, USOs, unidentified superconducting object.
I think we've come to the end of the program. Alan, I'd like to thank you very much for being here and being at the other end. And good luck with your search for better and better superconducting materials. And
okay.
Well, yes,
thank
you very much. Thanks. We're very happy that we had Alan Jacobson, the professor of chemistry and chemical engineering at the University of Houston. Thanks very much for being on Science Studio. And also thanks to Norman Martinez, our producer.
Yeah, and thanks the listener for being there. And we will be back next week with another program. So you be there. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with today's Life Sciences Flash. Integrated Medical Systems, a California company, will commercialize its portable intensive care unit in El Paso. UTEP and Texas Tech El Paso will help the process. The device, which has been nicknamed Suitcase ICU, was initially designed for the military. The 40-pound unit will be intended for adults and pediatric patients. This Life Sciences Flash brought to you by Synapse, the region's life sciences news digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.